And now.
Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça. Ela, menina que vem, que passa. Num doce balanço, caminho do mar.
Your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Moça do corpo dourado, do sol de Ipanema. O seu balançado é mais que um poema. É a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar.
With Dean Haglund and Phil Lernes.
Ah, por que estou tão sozinho? Ah, por que tudo é tão triste? Ah, beleza que existe. A beleza que não é só minha, que também passa sozinha. Ah, se ela soubesse que quando ela passa, o mundo sorrindo se enche de graça e fica mais lindo por causa do amor.
Celebrity Deaths.
Welcome to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, everybody. This is Phil Lernes, and don't worry. Don't worry, that's not another Southern California earthquake you feel. That's just the excitement building over this installment of our free weekly podcast. And here is the host of the show from Motor City, your friend in podcasting, television's very own Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Hey, good, Phil. I didn't realize I'm the host of the show. I would have presented some snacks, some tea, perhaps.
You used to, for crying out loud. And people would hear us
eating. By us, I mean you.
That was one of the things. I almost picked a different historic clip for us to play this week. But it was only to prove that it wasn't just me. On episode, I guess it was 10 of this show, back when we were from the heart of Hollywood, you no sooner do you get halfway through the introduction of the line welcoming people to the offices of Rational Exuberance and Cinema Arts Entertainment than you start eating during the introduction. It's amazing. It is amazing. Like, you're having your breakfast.
Well, those cookies were fresh out of the oven. I mean,
we were in the office. What oven? It was early Monday morning. You were probably hungover, and you needed your breakfast. You needed to soak all that liquor up from the weekend. But we won't be eating now, and one of the reasons we won't be eating now is that we find ourselves starting the show in the Chilpack morgue, and you don't want to eat in front of the corpses because it's rude. They might feel left out.
Right.
And at the outset, you heard a special opening of the show featuring João Gilberto, Brazilian singer, songwriter, guitarist, popularly known as the father of bossa nova. He died this weekend at the age of 88. And this was a big deal to me.
You bossa nova.
Oh my God. Who bossa novas more than Dean Haglund and Phil Lernes on road trips?
I can't think of a single person. Yes, in fact, Elvis's very own rendition of Bossa Nova is a favorite of mine.
João Gilberto, the father of Bossa Nova, he pioneered that genre in the late 1950s. I could seriously enjoy doing an entire hour all about the music of João Gilberto. I believe the track that I played, although I didn't just put this together, I did it after I heard the news. I think I played Girl from Ipanema, which was from the Gilberto Gets album, 1966, Gilberto Gets 2. Gets being, of course, the great jazz saxophonist Stan Getz, and of course, whatever Stan wants, Stan gets. As soon as the news broke about Mr. Gilberto, I texted two of my groomsmen, because I was really shook up about the death. I texted both Steve Lem and Mike Stewart that this death was rough for me. I mean, sure, I didn't actually know that he was still alive.
Right.
But, you know, still finding out definitively that he was, and then, and in so doing, finding out that he isn't anymore. That's a rough one. And and Steve responded to me, it's like he died for you all over again. And indeed, we are planning a barbecue to listen to his music and to toast to his artistry on July 20th. So if you're going to be in the Los Angeles area, everybody, stop by. It'll be in Silver Lake, just down the road from the Lo Bianca house where the Manson family committed those murders. Mike Stewart texted me back saying, it's almost harder when someone sort of dies twice. And I think that really sums up how I felt this weekend.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. That's very sad. I'm sorry. So that party happened?
No, the 20th. July 20th.
Dean, oh, July 20th.
It's the 8th of July. So
it feels like the 20th.
Book your plans.
I'm booking them now.
Hey, you know, speaking of booking plans, right, we have unfinished business involving the Lost Spirits Distillery, which is in a new location. I guess it's reopened in a new locale.
Wow.
So we're going to have to look into that. But one of the reasons I know this is because the manager of the immersive Alice in Wonderland cocktail experience, in which Lily's acting in Hollywood at a pop-up location there in Hollywood, the manager of that worked for Lost Spirits Distillery until the
fire. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on. What a small world. What did he say? How did the fire start? Did he go into details?
Do you know, that would be, I mean, we'll have to have the manager on for an interview.
I guess so.
About that.
So.
All right.
But we're invited back. We still have the invite, right?
Somewhere? Yeah, of course we're invited back. We didn't start the fire. All right.
Okay. Now.
That's a little bit of my bossa nova stylings. What? You seem to have something really important before we get to the next body. What is it that you want to?
Well, how are you reading all these emails if you have no eyes?
Look, we've got bodies to get to here. Cameron Boyce, Disney Channel star Cameron Boyce.
This is weird.
Died in his sleep. The 20-year-old actor starred in several Disney shows, including Descendants. Cameron Boyce was a friend of our old friend Ethan Dettenmeyer and would help out with some of those charity things. Though I must say that Cameron Boyce was never on my radar. I did not see Descendants TV series and movies. Apparently, young Mr. Boyce was filming a new HBO show, Mrs. Fletcher. He was only 20, but he had racked up a series of big credits, including Grown Ups and Grown Ups 2. Playing one of Adam Sandler's kids. He was only 11 when he first appeared on the Disney Channel. His other credits include Shake It Up, Austin and Ally, Good Luck Charlie. And his breakout role was something called Jesse, on which he played Luke for 4 seasons. Were you a big fan of Jesse? You're a big Disney Channel guy, oddly enough.
Well, it's oddly only because a lot of my friends write for the Disney Channel or produce. You know, Steve Marmo, it's a machine. You know, you start with Disney Radio and you comb the nation for young budding talent, and non-Disney radio, you develop their voices and their personalities and then channel them into these Disney. And I'm using air quotes around sitcoms. They're not really comedic, but they are situational, and it gives these young performers the chance to develop chops and learn on set as things go and develop a fan base and work their way up. And,
it's been a while since I've seen even a moment of any of these, but what I was struck by when I would spend time around some kids who did watch these a few years back, including my goddaughter, was that It's interesting that you say that sitcoms, though not particularly funny, a lot of these shows were multi-camera. They were throwbacks in terms of the way that they were actually produced.
Absolutely, because it was cheaper to do a multi-camera setup to get all your A, B, and C shots in. And you can get these things in, out, have it shot in 3 days, and turn out product and have these kids. You know, Britney Spears came from this model. And it is kind of a throwback to the studio system, where they would find young talents, sign them into contracts, have them train when they weren't on camera, and when they were on camera, continue with their schooling and their education. So this is a thing that Disney still does.
So that when they are chewed up and spit out, when they grow up to be not so cute, they at least have that GED certificate to fall back on.
That is the criticism of the Disney machine.
But it's not just it's not just Disney, right? It's literally show business. Don't let kids act. I mean, we need to have stories obviously involving children, and that means we have to have child performers. But for the love of God, the odds are so stacked.
I know.
Against
for every Ron Howard success story, there is a litany of Jackie Coogan's and, you know, however many that you want to name.
And, you know, Lily was pointing this out. You know, Opie, Ron Howard, is illustrative of something that ought to be considered, which is certainly don't make the kid the star. Don't make the kid the main character. The child needs to be supporting, cannot be doing the heavy lifting, also should not be thrust into the major spotlight. Those are both so hazardous. We don't know if these things contributed to young Mr. Boyce's death. The family has said that he passed away in his sleep due to a seizure, which was a result of an ongoing medical condition for which he was being treated. And that is so odd. I have no idea what the hell is being said there.
Yeah. Well, I would assume perhaps, I mean, seizures always suggest to me epilepsy, but and that's treatable. We'll have to wait for more reports on that before we speculate.
I mean, an ongoing medical condition that could lead to sudden death in your sleep at age 20 and yet doesn't cause any red flags in Disney's or HBO's insurance clearances seems odd to me. But
that is a bit odd.
But then again, we're going to be writing a scene that involves insurance exams and clearances in a script we're going to be working on. So maybe it's a good question to just stick a pinhole in right there.
Right.
As we move on to one that hits close to home for you, because you've been talking about this man's work, though not necessarily mentioning him by name, these past few weeks. And that's Artie Johnson, who died at 90. Artie Johnson, one of the stars on the hip comedy sketch show Laugh-In.
Which we are now in season 3 of binge-watching on Amazon Prime. And I got to say, we were sort of doing a rudimentary IMDb search on many of the performers we saw on the show. And literally, I would say, 8 hours before the news of his death, I said, hey, Artie Johnson's still alive. And I believe now I'm living in a haunted fear that if I say that out loud, it's like Candyman. I'm the harbinger, of one's death if I look them up on any sort of internet search and exclaim that they're still alive. So I stopped doing that.
Oh man, cue Candyman.
I know,
we've had
right?
So many musical cues this month.
No, not the key music Candyman. All right. The horror movie Candyman.
Obviously, Artie Johnson created many. I mean, I have not seen Laugh-In since I was a kid, and I remember Wolfgang, the ex-German soldier.
It's very interesting.
Very interesting. And the old man who would...
on Ruth Buzzy. Oh, let's do that.
Yeah, proposition the old lady on the park bench.
Yeah. And then there's this really bizarre one he's doing. It's Mickey Mouse. He's sort of this high squeaky mouse thing. It's, oh, that's surreal. Look for that in season two. Then he's also the guy on the tricycle. I didn't realize I'm on the high speed sort of yakety sax cutaways that they do. And there's always a tricycle that runs into something that falls over. And cue laugh track. I'm not sure why, but maybe it was funny in the 60s. However, yeah, he's quite also the Russian in season one, the guy who comes out and sings gibberish Russian and starts dancing uncontrollably is clearly where Martin Short got all his physical comedy from. It's almost a direct copy of Artie Johnson.
He got his start on Broadway. He was part of that wave of these performers that became fixtures in comedy on television after moving to Los Angeles from Broadway.
Right.
And there was something to that. What they were, you know, the skills that they were honing there on Broadway at the time.
Right.
That then lent themselves to become such indelible comedic performers, usually in supporting roles, right? The likes of Paul Lynde and Charles Nelson Reilly. And looking at his credits, Artie Johnson really was a fixture, especially through 1960s television. He had memorable roles on The Andy Griffith Show. There's the second Andy Griffith Show reference of the day. When if you call in, when we make our third reference, the first
get a prize.
The first 10,000 kids 14 and under will win a Chilpak Hollywood Hour tote bag. He was also on Bewitched, but I honestly, you know, it was one of those things I remember as a kid when he would show up as a guest star, and it's oh that guy, but
right.
Because of Laugh-In, it was always. To me, no matter what he was doing, Laugh-In was just such a big deal that it was always Artie Johnson kind of standing outside the character. I was seeing Artie Johnson doing another character. Does that make sense?
It does make sense until you see this Mickey Mouse thing. It's a standalone.
And obviously, Andy Griffith and Bewitched, they're before Laugh-In. So
yes.
It's not like he wasn't playing characters. It's just that Laugh-In is such a big deal.
Yeah, and breaking the mold too in terms of everybody stepping outside of the fourth wall, the improvisational elements to it.
Yeah,
you know, clearly they had to shoot so much so fast that it seemed what you were seeing on camera was the first take and only take. And that's what they went with.
And that's what I'm looking for whenever I saw him in other things. I'm waiting for the fourth wall break.
Yes, absolutely. And because he was a professional, there was this ultimately a twinkle in his eye and a sense of joy in all his performances.
Oh, yeah, there was.
He really everybody was. Else. Yeah, it was. It really is quite fascinating to see how much he's enjoying himself performing on Laugh-In.
Hey, was he touring with the live Laugh-In show? This year?
I don't know if he was, because I saw that special that they shot at the Kodak Theater, and I don't think he was there. Ruth Buzzy was there. They had all the stars, but I don't think Artie Johnson had the ability to make it, if I read that correctly.
Well, I'm going to go on record, and I'm going to be the first then to suggest that being excluded is what killed him.
I'm sure he was invited. So, how dare you?
So from a comedian close to your heart to someone who lived and worked even closer to where you are now, Lee Iacocca.
Yes.
The iconic automaker whose name I can't even read without hearing in my inner James Earl Jones the words Lee Iacocca as Chrysler to design a sports car. So that's what I remember from my childhood. But he was truly, I mean, how many automakers that did not get busted for cocaine trafficking and whose cars were subsequently used in science fiction comedy franchises of the 1980s? How many other automakers from that era can you name off the top of your head?
There, very few.
It's like Lee Iacocca and then Cautionary Tales. You know, I know John DeLorean. If I go back a few years, I know Tucker. You know, I know anyone who had cautionary conspiracy movies made about them. All right.
Right.
But Iacocca is amazing because I remember him as the success story and totally gloss over the fall, right? So his story is such a fascinating rise, fall, rise again. You know, he helped create such iconic models at Ford as the Escort and the Mustang before heading to Chrysler, turning that company from near failure to great success. And at Chrysler, his innovations included the development of the minivan, which would literally revolutionize. I mean, it would sadly get rid of those really retrospectively cool station wagons. Exactly. So the story is really interesting, and I won't I won't belabor too many of the biographical details, but I think some are informative. I mean, he's born in 24 in Allentown, Pennsylvania, so he's born of the Rust Belt, right?
Exactly. He's got a coursing through his blood.
He starts working at Ford Motor Company after graduating from Lehigh University and Princeton University, and he began his career in engineering to complement his degree that he was working on in industrial engineering. And he soon moved then into sales and marketing. Like, I already like this guy's story because we think about all these executives today in corporate world. They come, as you point out, from MBA backgrounds. They sometimes come from legal backgrounds, sometimes both. But this guy comes from engineering and then almost, you know, wants to augment his knowledge of the business. So he switches into sales and marketing. And he begins to rise through the ranks of the company with that combination of knowledge that would culminate in the presidency of Ford from 70 to 78. Can you imagine that? You start as an engineer, you move into sales and marketing, and you find yourself as president of the company. I don't know if that kind of trajectory is even possible in modern corporate lifestyle.
I don't think it is, because now, you know, your boards, your shareholders, they're all looking for kind of a ubiquitous uniformity in their leadership, that they have a certain university, a certain degree on their resume, that they've been to so many boards. He was definitely a maverick in that sort of thing. Also, as I recall, you know, he was also the first to really take responsibility. He took that full page ad out when many of the cars were rolling back their odometers because executives were using the new cars and then selling them on the dealership. And the full page ad was, that was a mistake. It is my responsibility. I apologize. It won't happen again. So he single-handedly changed the culture of a lot of these car companies.
What about,
and that culture was dropping in sales, right?
Well, what about the Pinto scandal? So he gets fired from Ford in the wake of the Pinto recall scandal. And
the exploding gas tank.
Right. The exploding gas tank, it's ubiquitous, you know, the joke, or they were ubiquitous at the time. Jokes about the Pinto.
Yeah, it's a standard punchline.
And he was one of the architects of the car. And you know, so the jokes and the scandal maybe can cause you to ignore the fact that in order for it to become a popular joke and such a famous scandal, the car itself had to be really popular. And it was.
It sold well.
It sold well as a subcompact, right, leading up to the 78 recall for that structural flaw that resulted in some of the Pintos bursting into flames after rear-end collisions. Here's the thing. Later, the defect was actually deemed comparable to the problems in competitors' cars.
But I did not know that.
But Ford had trouble living down the public relations disaster, right? So often in PR, that's it. The bottom line is not the bottom line. And so Iacocca had to go. He took the fall for that. And what a fall it was. And yet, There's a guy, like we said, had a hand in not only designing Ford's Mustang and the Escort, but also the Lincoln Continental Mark VIII model that was really popular. So he leaves Ford rather disgraced, one could say. But there's something about the way that he does it, and it's got to be, like you said, that attitude of taking responsibility that makes Chrysler, which is absolutely, admittedly, desperate. I don't know if Chrysler gets away, as desperate as they were, with hiring Lee Iacocca in the wake of a Pinto scandal if you live in the era of 24-hour news and social media. I think the nonstop hits they take from the 2% of the population that are on social media all the time is so enormous that they rethink it, right? Because the publicity hit would be too much. But nevertheless, in the late 70s, he does join Chrysler, hoping to turn around the company's desperate slump. He secures a loan guarantee from the U.S. Congress, spearheads new projects, including the K-Car and the development of the minivan, as well as the acquisition of American Motor Company's AMC, which included the Jeep, right?
The Jeep, specifically, yeah. That's what it was.
And by the time of his retirement in 92, Iacocca had turned Chrysler from a company near collapse into a quite successful company.
Right. And he was doing that by very specifically having a book of goals that every meeting he would have. And then he would put all of his executives under him to the very task of, did they complete their goals this week? This is what we're aiming for. And aligned very specifically the entire company towards a very specific end in terms of sales, in terms of design, and then systematically walked everybody. He had a book that he wrote down, a list of goals to accomplish that week, that month, that year. And every meeting, all the other executives were also challenged to keep a similar book and to meet those goals. And this was an example of, if ever there is a book on goal planning and how to succeed, it's following Lee Iacocca's model.
If, again, it's a different world back then. Like we said, to sum up for those scoring at home, in the modern world, I don't think someone with Lee Iacocca's background becomes the CEO, the president of corporations, right?
Right.
And in present day, I don't think someone in that position maybe even takes the fall for scandals like these. I don't think we see that level of responsibility. We don't generally see responsibility for their own actions anymore,
right?
Let alone for the people under their command, right?
Yeah,
which was really,
exactly.
It was the captain of a ship kind of mentality. So in the modern age, I don't think a man like Iacocca gains power. In an era like today, I don't think he lets go of that power. And in an era like today, if he does lose that power, I don't think he's given such an immediate opportunity to turn things around. So he's a fascinating figure of American culture in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, for sure. Even here in Detroit, it's quite fascinating to see how beloved he is. And they're even saying his funeral is welcome, like they're advertising when his funeral is. So he seems to be most revered here in this town.
We move from our segment honoring and celebrating the lives of notable figures who have left us over the last couple weeks to a segment of futures past, as I'm toying with the notion of calling it, where we revisit things we were talking about 12 years ago this week. And until Pack Hollywood Hour number 10, I think it's safe to say this discussion, Dean, was out of this world.
Well, I want to hear all about your weekend. Mm-hmm. You spent it in Roswell, New Mexico, did you not?
At the 60th anniversary of the Roswell incident, as it's known. They don't call it the crash, you know, because not everyone believes. So, therefore, it's just the incident. And it was parades and shows and stuff. But what was amazing was there was actually serious researchers and panel discussions that was, for the first time in 25 years, taken seriously by the press. Washington Post bureau chief came to the event and actually reported seriously on the front page.
So so talk to me a little bit about the history of this thing. I mean, I understand, of course, the history that it's based on. But is this the first time you'd ever been to one of these events? And had you ever been to Roswell before?
I'd never been to Roswell before.
Is Roswell, I mean, obviously, you know, like Area 51, Dreamland in Nevada is kind of mecca for UFO enthusiasts. Mm-hmm. Is Roswell year-round a mecca for
It is.
This?
But what it is they have a lot of goofy green stuffed alien toys and hilarious pins and funny T-shirts all along the main street. The town is just sort of, you know, 50,000 people. But then 45 minutes out of town, there's one crash site. 75 minutes out of town, there's the other crash site, which might be because apparently the saucer came in, hit the ground, skipped, went 30 miles, and then landed a second spot.
Hmm.
So, and some will tell you it didn't. The second spot is the sham that is just there for tourists because it's near a road. And the first one you have to, you know, four-wheel it out to the middle of nowhere, which is where the archaeological dig is. You know, there's always amongst everything, but a lot of infighting. But what's amazing about this is that because it was a space saucer crash, originally the military issued a press release saying we found a flying saucer. It was crashed. Here it is. And then about 3 days later, suddenly all the press was off. Everybody who was involved was transferred all over the place. The doctors that worked with the bodies that they found out there all disappeared and everything was hushed up. And nobody actually knew about it. Even people who lived in Roswell, who grew up there, never actually knew this happened until about the late 70s, early 80s, when the book started coming out and the researchers started finding this stuff out.
Well, so, except that I knew about Roswell, New Mexico, when I was a kid. I mean, I knew about it in the
70s.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So this kind of, I think, answered one of the questions I was going to have, which is that there's no chance. You know, you pointed out that there's the second crash site. It's near a road. You know, all the stuffed green aliens and things like that. You know, there's no chance that this originally was some kind of hoax or marketing gimmick to try to generate revenue for the town, right? Because at that time, I mean, that was kind of the watershed event. There was no interest in UFOs, right?
No. This happened July 6, 1947. Before that, nobody actually even knew or the term flying saucers. Most of the sightings and everything happened after the 50s or in the 50s after that first crash in 1947.
Right. So that's interesting.
Yeah, it was pretty fascinating.
And
I have interviewed tons of people, and it's going to be on my sister broadcast, Paranoia Will Destroy You, which you can get through deanhaglund.com.
Wow.
And listen
I'm
to that.
Jealous.
Well, you know.
I'm jealous that you're actually giving the good content to the sister.
Oh, it's not good content.
Oh,
this is from the
Are you saying it's bad content?
No, this is where we talk about filmmaking.
All right. First off, Dean, I love that there's this debate at the end about whether a discussion over UFOs and Roswell is suitable for Chill Pack Hollywood Hour back then from the heart of Hollywood, because this is where we talk about movies. That's what you say at the end. So let's start at the ending maybe and work our way through.
Let's start at that. Good Lord. Because I don't remember ever planning another podcast.
Where can I find that podcast, Paranoia Will Destroy You?
Well, it's on my list of tons of shit and of ideas that I have never fully executed.
Yeah, you know. I know. I mean, I've come up with other ideas for podcasts too and stuff. But the truth is, as I increasingly over the years describe this very show, what do we talk about on this show? We really actually talk about anything that has grabbed our attention.
I know.
And almost always we do tie it into some depiction of that topic in the media.
Right. Culturally, how is it affecting culture?
Yeah.
As per?
Yeah.
It's a cultural exploration of what's going on around us.
So anyway, that was funny to find out.
That was funny. I go into that too. I go, Jesus, I don't remember planning another podcast called that one.
You referred to it as a sister podcast. And so I felt like, oh my God, our sister podcast was separated from us at birth. And at 12, she's going through some of her most vulnerable growing pains right now. We really ought to track her down.
So it's fascinating.
Your first trip, I was stunned to realize that that was your first trip to Roswell.
With
UFO mythology having played a no small part in your life and career.
I know. Well, but it also, to be fair, Roswell's not really close to anything.
No, it isn't. It isn't. Although, I told you, you know, I finally visited there on my big road trip June of 2017. And it's less than an hour from the site of the Lincoln County Wars. And that's where I stayed there in Lincoln, New Mexico.
Had
a spectacular bed and breakfast and did some filming. One of the spots, the tiny little areas throughout the Southwest that are kind of preserved because of, you know, they continue to make enough tourist money off their legacy of celebrating gun violence of our formational years. Roswell, you refer to Roswell as goofy, with all the goofy aliens and decor.
Yeah, back then it was like, you know, green, fun, you know.
I'll tell you, I couldn't get enough of it. I could not get enough of it. I think every main street of every small town in America should be decked out in alien paraphernalia like Roswell is. It's just a good look. It's a good look.
It's a good look. I'm going to say that. However, you know, what are they, green men with big eyes? Do we know? How did we not know they're not the Pleiadians or the reptilians or the, you know, it's a... It's
oh my God!
Somewhat
so your problem is with the lack of anatomical correctness and
or species correctness. You know, technically.
Oh my God, that's hilarious! No. That's hilarious. You fear now that Roswell is setting back alien-human relations because of their depictions.
Listen, if Perry Farrell...
That was a reference. That was a reference to that. Perry Farrell feeling that way about the X-Files.
Exactly.
So you do reference in there that you visited, you know, the two different crash sites, that there are two different ones, that there's debate about it. Since the time that you went, signage, especially for the actual site... is gone. I mean, it is really, really tough. Nobody wants any visitors there. So, you know, you need satellite imagery, trusty GPS, really good shoes. Anyway, so
And you got to be friends with, I mean, it's on private land. You're trespassing no matter how you try to find it.
But what is interesting is I was thinking about some of the things we've learned in the years since you visited then. Like one thing we learned when we were doing The Truth Is Out There and that's in The Truth Is Out There is that you made a common mistake when you were speaking about this, about how it's when flying saucer enters the lexicon, right?
Right.
And yet, as we learned, it was actually the Maury Island sighting of Kenneth Arnold in Washington State that predated Roswell. Certainly at the same time there in the late 40s. But that was the watershed that a lot of people attribute to Roswell. In fact, in a bizarre cruel twist of branding fate, a lot of people end up referring to the Maury Island incident as Pacific Northwest's Roswell. even though it came first, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that we've learned, which rocked both of our worlds a little bit, was that certainly in this country, and we're not talking metaphoric descriptions of what probably were UFOs, right? Like biblical descriptions. We mean literal descriptions of flying saucers, of alien spacecraft, going back to the 1890s in Aurora, Texas, right? We visited the cemetery where pilot of an alien spacecraft was buried in 1897.
Right, with the description of going, this guy's from something weird that crashed over there, just on that road there, sort of thing. You could see the road from his tombstone, its tombstone.
And so that little bit is featured in part two of The Truth Is Out There that'll be coming along soon-ish, certainly early 2020. And which is perfect because hindsight is 2020, and look at all the mistakes we have to correct. But yeah, we learned that in your interview with Jim Mars, with the journalist and writer Jim Mars. I believe the final interview Jim gave before his death. And
right.
So it's been interesting how the learning has continued. Have you since that time when you were there? Well, first of all, have you been back to Roswell since then?
Since then, no. I don't think I have because I was driving. No, we went through El Paso and down that way. We didn't get up through Roswell. So I have not been back. Isn't that sad?
I guess. Sure. It's sad. I reached out. I've been trying to suggest that a Dean Haglund art show there makes a lot of sense at the museum. Well, you know, I'll try. I'll try again.
Okay.
Yeah. I was met with silence, and yet I sense beneath the silence
and excitement
and a sadness. Okay.
Sadness. Oh.
Have you learned anything about Roswell since then that you were struck in realizing when you listened to that clip?
No, I was actually going through my head and going, well, what was the other news that came out? And, you know, there was revisitations on what actually crashed. What was it? Was it now Russian? Do they consider it alternative technology? I heard also that it's possible that that's one of our own time traveling devices gone to hell, and that we steered it to the desert and it came out at a different time in a quantum bubble that we crossed a time barrier of some sort. So the information, the research, the misinformation continues to come out of Roswell. Perhaps it's not as resonant in our current cultural motif as it used to be, say when we were there, but it still holds a thing. It still holds a touchstone, as it were, to the mythology of UFOs.
Well, I'm no expert on Roswell. I'm no student of it. I would say that it continues to hold our imagination in some ways, because there is no question that something happened, right? This is an actual crash, an actual incident, as you refer to it, took place. And
the Air Force reported it to the local newspaper and then retracted it a couple of days later.
But some incident happened, and then and there was from the beginning so much misinformation, whether that is willful misleading or not, or just error, whether it's breathless journalism, whether it's breathless reporting, whether it's loose lip, whether it's speculation, whatever it is, there was so much misinformation from the beginning that you combine those elements plus the very rural nature of this. It's fascinating, and there's never been any kind of definitive suggestion or explanation,
right?
Yeah, for whatever reason. So, we have a note to our affiliates. We are going to run long because we have so much that we've promised to get to, and we should at least try to get to it. I think we'll pick up the email from our listener that we teased at the end of last week's show.
Oh yeah.
Hello, Dean and Phil.
Hey, that's us.
First of all, I wanted to thank Dean for the kind words. It was an honor to finally meet face to face, and was humbled by receiving the title of Venerable. Doubt I'll ever live up to that, but we'll certainly try. Hope one day to cross paths with Phil as well. You know, Dean, there's no better way to become venerable than to cross paths with Phil.
Just without any scotch in your head, I guess.
However, the real purpose of my email is to pose a question for discussion to the both of you.
Mm.
Is it better for television show runners and writers to have an idea of where the show they're writing is headed, or better to explore what they can with the characters and stories before deciding on a fitting ending? I'm going to come back to that question in a second, and we'll finish up the email. A number of shows such as The X-Files, Game of Thrones, and many others have gotten a largely negative response for the endings of the show. These seem to explore the characters without having a real goal of where the show is headed. While this can be enjoyable, it seems to leave fans of the show wanting more, or at least a better conclusion, once production has stopped. On the other hand, shows such as Breaking Bad had a clear vision from the very beginning. Having this stated by the showrunners many times, everyone basically knew what was coming, but still tuned in to see it. However, this end goal idea may be slower to attract viewers, in which case the show fails to reach a payoff because it gets canceled. Curious to see what you, what the two of you think on the subject. Loyal member of the Chilpak Nation, Agent Summer. P.S. I'm writing in the largest font that was available, so in hope that Phil can read this. Also sending best wishes for a full recovery soon. So I could read that. First of all, my laptop, off which I did read it, is no longer sporting inverted colors. It looks like a normal laptop again.
Hey.
I am able to see that. I am able to see our waveform as we recorded this. I am able to see our playlist to drop clips over through most of one eye.
But the eye that hasn't been operated on, because the last picture you put on Facebook, you had a big patch over the eye that was operated on. Is that patch off?
Yeah, a week later, that patch, believe it or not, is off. Yes. And
that eye is operational. It's fully functional.
No, through most of that eye, it's fully functional. So thank you for asking.
You're welcome. I was saving it for everybody's interest.
So, you know, since I last spoke, I had the surgery. And, of course, at where we left off, Phil's surgeon was ready to throw up her hands after the failure to get and say, well, she literally said, I'm just going to have to work my magic. And work her magic she did.
Yay!
So I can, you know, it's still going to be in flux for a few more weeks, this eye, and I still have to get the other eye. So we won't know where my vision is going to settle for probably a month. But I can read these things and see these things on the computer and do all these things without any glasses at all.
Clearer than before.
I am going to need, I believe, reading glasses. However, I think the prescription for those reading glasses will be the same prescription I first got 12 years ago when I got reading glasses, or 10 years ago when I got reading glasses.
So right off the shelf, you can just buy them off the rack.
All the vision loss I have suffered since then, in large part due to the cataracts themselves. They tested my distance, you know, the day after when I had a follow-up, the day after the surgery. 20/20 vision? No. 2015.
Ooh.
So I see... That's better. Yeah, it means at 15 feet, or I see things at 20 feet as if they were only 15 feet away.
Wow. You're Bionic Man.
So she worked her magic indeed. One of the things she told me, and not something that is, again, very common, but these are uncommon, very rare cataracts, the density of them was such that the proteins, because they're proteins, they're a growth of proteins, was attaching to the eyeball itself.
Good.
So I still have some cataract in my left eye, even though the entire lens has been replaced.
Good.
So you were
awake. You saw a scalpel coming towards your eye. How'd you handle that?
So those will need to be lasered away at some point. What can you see? Yes, this is the very question that had me in terror, in abject
terror.
Because they don't put you out, right? They give you a really strong cocktail, and it is a good cocktail. But when the anesthesiologist came and introduced herself, beforehand, she asked, "How are you doing?" And I kind of mumbled an answer, and then I said, "I'm scared." And she said, "Yeah, you are. Yeah, you, everything about you seems terrified." And I was thinking, like, how can I be so different than anybody else? I think part of the thing is that I'm probably 20 years younger than most of the people they're working on. So I have a lot more energy towards the terror and the imagination.
Sure.
And, you know, that's really it. This is one of the things I would talk about with my goddaughter when she felt like, you know, that she's scared a lot and that she's, you know, some kind of cowardly person. Whereas, in fact, I know her to be quite brave. It's, you know, fear is often a sign of imagination.
Right. You imagine you think the worst case scenario and you freak yourself out.
Or I imagine what like the question of the scalpel. A lot of people might think, well, no, why? How would they do such a thing? And then they stop thinking about it. But it was great because I was telling her the surgeon the next day. I was so relieved because of what I could see, and it was like really fun for her because nobody's ever bothered to tell her what they can see while it's going on. And it's just like a great, colorful light show.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, the cataract is such that I can't see clearly anyway.
All right.
So it's not like I would get a clear image of somebody coming towards me. But also the lights that they shine in, they dilate your pupils, and the lights they shine in and where they need to shine it and everything – it's playing off parts of your eyes. So I never even saw her. I never even saw anyone around me. I went from seeing the lights overhead as I was being gurneyed into the surgical studio. And then I saw these multicolored lights. There was a pretty, really weird section that most people wouldn't experience because she did, in the middle of the procedure, do more measuring tests just to get every bit of information she can to do her magic. Yeah. And that's a process that usually doesn't happen. But so it was really, I came out of it the next day going kind of, let's get in on the other one right now. Let's go. And of course you can't, you got to wait for the first one to heal, but that itself is really
rapid.
Well, it's rapid-ish. I mean, I'm taking so many drugs and so many eye drops and stuff. And, you know, and there's still flicker and there's some other things. But the biggest problem for me is that I got one eye that works and one eye that really doesn't. and it's crazy to really realize how I've been seeing. Like, I'll close my right eye, which is the one with the cataract still, and I'll see things clearly, and then I'll reverse it, and it's like I'm looking through cheesecloth.
Wow, that bad.
So
you're gonna wear sunglasses from now on too?
I kind of need to all the time right now anyway. But so the question about TV shows.
Exactly.
You know, this is an interesting time to get this question because I've been watching season 3 of Stranger Things and season 2 of Big Little Lies.
Uh-huh.
And I would argue that Big Little Lies is a show that knew probably where it was going. from the beginning. And I'm, as a result, I'm kind of finding it often distasteful because so much of it revolves around the aftermath of, you know, a violent relationships affected by a violent man, by an abusive, sexually predatory man. And and so as the show goes on and the complications arise, more and more I just feel like we're using the reality, because it was very realistically depicted, but the reality of an abusive personality and abusive relationships, we're using those as plot points.
Right. As opposed to character points.
Yeah, and that's and that's really manipulative and exploitive.
Yeah.
And Stranger Things season 3.
Yeah.
They may have had some idea of plot where they were going. But you know, a lot of people love the Stranger Things. And the first two seasons of Stranger Things were many things, but I would never say that good was one of them. And I watched I watched them all. I mean, I enjoyed it. I wanted it to be really good. And at times I loved it. And at times I, you know, really got a ball, had a ball watching it. But I would never really say that it rose to the level of good until season three. Season three is good. And it's the first time where I feel like they are in present day telling a story that was set back in the mid 80s, as opposed to trying to live in the mid 80s or in trying to make something as if it was made then, or, you know, some sort of cute ideas that they're trying to live out. And they're really telling a story that was set in the 80s now, and therefore they're commenting on the 80s in some fascinating ways. You know, there's commentary. But the other thing that I think only comes about because of how smart they cast it and because of the affection that people ended up having for it, I feel like Stranger Things has supplanted the Harry Potter universe as the genre coming of age stories.
Fascinating.
That really matter to young people.
Interesting. Because then this is always the thing. It's about context, right? And if you plan a show to run 3 to 5 years and you have the ending in place, what invariably is going to happen is society and the world of which that will show will change so much that it won't resonate anymore in terms of, like you said, replacing the Harry Potter universe or in other matters, becoming like I think about Heroes, right? Heroes save the cheerleader, save the world. Well, they save the cheerleader and the world, and they have to continue. And then the whole thing stumbles and falls apart at the threads, and they go off on tangents that nobody cares about. And so you have a very, to my mind, a precarious balance between knowing where the show is going and having the ability to take in what's going on in present day and filtering that through your art and having that come out in the show.
Right. And it's not just what's going on in present day culturally or with your audience, but also with yourself and letting that into your work. What have you learned? And so I think that Stranger Things, the Duffer brothers, the people responsible for the making of the show, they've done that and probably have made some hiring changes and just some course corrections. They have evolved. This show has gotten better. Does that mean that it's a straight trajectory line that's going to keep getting better? Of course not. What this reminded me of was, you know, a show that you know that I enjoyed called Justified, starring Timothy Oliphant. And I enjoyed it even during some of the seasons that were shaky because I really enjoyed some of the characters. It was old television in the sense that if you liked the characters, you would follow it. And in old television, quote-unquote golden age of television, if these shows managed to produce one out of every three episodes to be really good, they were ahead of the curve because they were making so many episodes and at such a rapid pace that it was really difficult. But you would follow it because you enjoyed the characters, and that's how I felt about Justified. They got to, I think it was a season three, maybe it was a season two, that was so good. And you went, wow, they've really learned, they've really developed. But then it never was as good again in any of the subsequent seasons. And it wasn't because they didn't know where they were going. They did know from a plot sense where they were going. But they didn't know, I think from a character sense, how to convey those stories. Because it's not just that the story comes out of the character. It's also that the way you depict the world either ought to be the way that the character experiences the world, or depict that world in such a way that we're learning something about that character.
Right? Because I think back now to the example of Breaking Bad. You knew at the end that he had to have his comeuppance. There had to be some sort of intrinsic justice, as a word, to end the series. But at the same time, they didn't know Jesse was going to be a continuing intrinsic character. That, you know, that developed as the series went on. The Dean Norris character having such a complex, a problematic rise in the department as he chases Heisenberg. All of that was found as they wrote it. So, you know, you can have an end goal, but have it amorphous enough that you still develop and still have your personal expression, albeit, come out through that show. So just because you know how or where you want it to end doesn't necessarily mean that you have it completely scripted out from day one.
And doesn't necessarily mean it should end. This is what I'm going to argue. Let me come at this in a really weird way. So last night I watched the new latest episode of Big Little Lies, and there's a scene where the Reese Witherspoon character and her husband, played by Adam Scott, go for a couples retreat weekend, you know, therapy to Esalen, right? And as soon as they show it, I said, oh, my God, I hope they run into Don Draper. you know, who in the final episode of Mad Men ends up at Esalen. And I wished I hadn't thought it, because as soon as I thought it, I went, oh, my God, now that's a show. Now that's a show that knew where to go. It knew how to end. And then later in the evening, Lily said, has there actually ever been any other show that ended in a satisfying way other than Mad Men? Ever. And I've come up with a couple. But like, you know, basically any time Bob Newhart's involved.
Yeah, that's the only one I was thinking of. But Newhart wakes up and said, what a weird dream.
But because I think we maybe are putting the cart before the horse, this idea of having an idea where it ends, that it somehow is a product of storytellers wanting to do that, and not a product of the financial imperative that was born out of the Fugitive, the TV series The Fugitive, where the day the running stopped, you know, when Dr. Richard Kimball finally found the one-armed man, that 85% of the population was tuned in to watch that. It's this famous story that, you know, hospitals had to reschedule all surgeries to not be near then because everybody had to be able to watch it. Remember, there were no instant reruns. There was no recording. There were no... So, and then, you know, so that becomes, you know, this gold standard for how to end a show, but the emphasis is on gold, right? The amount of money made off that was everything. And so my God, that chase for money ends up finding its ultimate expression to me in the finale of MASH. Let's take a half-hour sitcom and have a three-hour dramatic finale.
Dramatic finale, and there wasn't a single laugh in there. That was the weird. And I didn't even watch it in real time. I had to work that night. But
it's three of the worst hours of television ever. It shows the utter distinction between the show Alan Alda wanted to be making and what the show actually was. I mean, the truth is, in its first few seasons, it's a hilarious, irreverent, subversive show.
Yes.
And it is the worst expression of sentimentality and nostalgia by the end of that show. Yeah. And
as Seinfeld as well, the season ender of Seinfeld.
Well, let's hold Seinfeld for a second. But okay. I would say that what MASH shows, and it should have been a warning sign for all of us, is that the money that can be made off these finales was so much that the powers that be, the financial powers that be, encourage showrunners or stars or whoever the creative powers are on a show to indulge their worst instincts.
Right.
And they all want to go, oh, yeah, I'll come up with a great ending. Oh, a great ending. Oh, and the truth is that in storytelling, the great ending is a product of a great beginning and even more a great second act.
Well, and now you come back to the writers. Some of them, you know, do they want it to end? Some don't, you know. Some are really sad that the show ends, and the sadness and the anger and all those emotions come out, and or they dry up for ideas because all they can think of are how to continue these characters. Wouldn't it be great if this happened to that guy? And then you go, yeah, but we got to end it. And you sit in the writer's room. And I've heard this story again and again where they're all just staring at each other going, I can't believe it's ending. And that's all they're writing down. And that's all. A deadline looms and they write some shit and that's it.
That's why Mad Men, the ending works so great, because what's the ending? It's that he's finally become what he was pretending to be at the very beginning.
Right.
That's the only real ending. And life goes on. History goes on. So let me flip the script here about do we want these to end? Why should we want them to end? I mean, people want closure. People want closure. Right. I mean, you hear this usually when people are breaking up with each other. And that's how people approach these things, with the emotions of like a breakup. We want closure. We want closure. It's Dr. Nicky Monti, who figures prominently in The Truth Is Out There, who once said to me, you know, the easiest relationships to leave are the healthiest ones.
Right.
Those are the ones that are easy to leave behind. It's the unhealthy ones where we desperately want closure and things like that. And that's something to look at. Our relationship with these things might be unhealthy if we're so desperate for closure. And inevitably, how satisfying is that closure, right? Unless that closure is this door is closing and another window is opening, right?
Another window is opening, which is Mad Men again. That's the whole thing.
And the window ought to be letting in fresh air and not the cold, dreary stench of a writer's room. So that's the mistake that Seinfeld made.
Yeah.
A show about nothing is going to have a satisfactory conclusion?
Well, but it was never a show about nothing. It was a farce over a melodrama is always the model. So by having a farce where none of the episodes ever ended with any conclusion,
exactly.
It always ended with every, you know, all the doors in the hallway all open at the same time after chases have been going on, you know, like every comedic farce from Scooby-Doo onwards and Molière, So how do you end a farce but making it more farcical? That's the only way you can. And did they make it more farcical? They didn't. It went more melodramatic, which that negated the concept that they knew what they were doing all along, sort of thing.
And so here's the, you know, that particular part of the question that Agent Summer, or the email, where she says that often shows are slower to attract viewers, in which case they fail to reach payoff because they get canceled. In recent times, especially like last decade, there were two examples of this where thank God that happened. Thank God. I really enjoyed the television series Firefly. Thank God it gets canceled because as a result, we get the Serenity movie.
Right.
Thank God. Right. Thank God Star Trek, the original series, gets canceled after 3 years. Because there's so many adventures left untold that we get an animated series, we get novels, we get a movie series, a satisfying movie series for the most part, as opposed to The Next Generation, which some could argue and some have was a better show than the original Star Trek, right? And it certainly ended great. It has a finale that's great. So there's a second one that's truly satisfying, is Next Generation's finale. And I don't mean that Mad Men's the only one, but what I do mean is these are the outliers. These are far and away the outliers. But Star Trek The Next Generation has a great ending, and then it goes to the big screen, and you go, well, why didn't they just save the final episode for a movie?
Yeah.
That would have been better, because no movie lived up to the final episode, and the movie series that ensued, unlike the original series movie series, was largely unsatisfying. And so, a la Firefly, at the same time, roughly, HBO has a wonderful Western series called Deadwood, and they don't get to conclude it. And for years, people are so just traumatized by that show not being given the conclusion it deserved. Well, as a result, they finally this year got to make a movie. And it doesn't give the show, quote unquote, the conclusion it deserved. No, it just goes back and looks at, well, where are they all these years later? And what could be the historic turning point that we want to look at? Oh, how about statehood? It created opportunities by leaving things, by not getting the closure. Everything was left open.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's something to be said for that. You know, be careful what you it also disturbs me that I'm going to tell a really weird story. I'm going to tell a really strange story. I once had a girlfriend who, for some strange reason, when at the end of one of our dates, wanted me to kiss her goodbye and, kiss her. I thought she meant, kiss me goodnight, right?
Right.
And she said, no, kiss me goodbye as if you were seeing me for the last time.
Wow.
So I did. I'm a method actor. I went into that scenario and embodied that energetic.
You didn't call for intervention at this point? And that would be alarming.
No, I called for my stuntman. But anyway, so I did that. And when I pulled away, she was deep in thought. And I said, what is it? And she said, it was identical to our first kiss 2 years ago.
Aww.
Okay. And what bothered me about that was it meant that the first time I kissed her, I was kissing her goodbye.
No.
And I was aware of how true that was because I knew that this couldn't last. All right. So why I bring that up is I feel like that's the relationship people now have with their television. They fall in love immediately with something, and the emphasis is all immediately on how is this going to end? The ending better be, okay, I'm loving this, I'm enjoying this, but you better not fuck me with a shitty ending.
No.
Or you better not get canceled before giving me a satisfying ending.
Right. Or you're going to be mad.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
And that, you know, she brought up the X-Files, the need for conclusion that Chris Carter gave into.
Yeah.
He gave into it in season 9 when he brings Duchovny back. The movie reflected their other impulse, which is let's have a universe where these characters continue to explore mysteries.
But in a relationship.
But my point is that was one of their impulses, clearly. But they would go back and forth between their impulses. And I think that's also born out of what we've talked about in the past, which is the X-Files is at this interesting precipice in time between when shows were truly episodic and when they had ongoing stories and mythologies. Yeah. And it was in between. And the latter ended up being the tale that wagged the dog.
Right. Yeah, that's the model everybody wants now. Because of marketing, that's also it became a really easy marketing
which is how the business has changed so much, right? Because binge watching is the name of the day, and as we've talked about before, what gets you to binge watch something? Well, it's I need to find out what happened next, which means you're talking about plot, which means as much as it's hooking you in the annals of time, it may not end up being something that really actually resonates or moves you very much because you're talking about plot, you're not talking about story. And if you're not talking about story, you're not talking about character. But plot is what hooks you. And so that's what you need to get people to binge watch. So these are quality productions, but that's why I think that television and episodic storytelling isn't as good now as it was when we started this podcast 12 years ago.
Interesting.
But in the old model, right, for broadcast television was, what are you doing telling a continuing story? Maybe you'd have a two-parter. Maybe you'd have a cliffhanger. But we're not telling continuing stories. And why are we not telling continuing stories? Because you're diminishing your audience. You don't want everybody to have to see every episode. These need to be standalone stories. And you know, and the X-Files was somewhere in between.
And again, it wasn't planned. Jillian got pregnant first season. They had to write her out. Why is she written out? It's an alien abduction over 3 episodes. Now there's an alien abduction scenario. This becomes a story arc, right?
They did hint at that in various ways going back to the beginning.
For sure. There's a spooky man in the corner without a name. What's he doing lurking there? There's a bigger story going on, for sure.
Are we searching for his sister? Are we not? You know, so there's hints at it and things. But it was always, I thought, supposed to be peripheral. But like I said, it became the tale that wagged the dog. So I don't know if we've come up to any answers. I know we're almost 80 minutes into the show. We had promised to get to a lot of movies. We won't get to any of them. We'll talk movies a lot next week. But to put a button on it, I mean, what would you say is the approach that gives you the best chance? I mean, this stuff is hard. There's a great show that lands the dismount is a once a decade occurrence, it seems.
Yeah.
So what gives you the best chance when you get started?
I think Mad Men Breaking Bad is the model in that your ending is the revealing of a truth, and then your beginning is having your character covered up so much that he doesn't even know what his truth is, and then connecting those two. That, to me, is the best chance for long-term success. And also your ability to spread that out or shorten that up as much as the studio demands or the execs demand.
I'm going to say a couple of things. First of all, I think in television especially, it's really effective when the story comes full circle. When you think of an arc as a, you know, if it's a circular structure, perhaps it's an ironic rebirth, perhaps, which is something that Kubrick was expert at in his movies, right? Or perhaps it's the solution of a mystery always comes full circle, because it comes back to the original sin, right? And but I'm not saying that a show has to be a mystery show, but in a way, they all have to be mystery shows, in that hopefully we are exploring the mystery of the human heart, the human mind, the human experience.
Right.
And if we're trying to really unravel something about our main character or characters, then it's that we want to resolve, in the sense that we want their journey to pay off for them. That's not the same thing as closure, right? In fact, right. It's probably a deepening into a new level of awareness, a new world of possibilities. You know, it's that kind of closure that opens up a larger realm of possibilities. And a la the end of Mad Men, a la the end of The Next Generation, a la the end of the new movie of Deadwood, etc. Otherwise, it's a fairly funereal process. And so I would say that, coming back full circle, I would also suggest that if you really do know that this is the canvas I want to write on, and this is the canvas that's best suited for the story I want to tell, and the exploration of these characters and the exploration of this world, and the episodic format is the right canvas for this story, as opposed to a novel, as opposed to a play, as opposed to a movie, that this is what this is for, then if you know where it ends, if you already see that story, then decide how many episodes it is at the start. And commit to that, and force that, and find the right, because everything's possible now. You can absolutely, I mean, right now we're at this weird place where so often it's the networks that can't continue a show because of the costs of it, even when it's successful. Because when it's successful, it becomes more costly.
So, yeah, right?
So make that deal in advance. Here's how many episodes it is, right? And iron that out in advance, because when you get into the game of, okay, we know where we're going, but how do we keep it going?
Well, then it becomes a revenue maker. I mean, yeah, from an executive point of view, I see that problematic, but I hear what you're saying from an artistic point of view. It's a great idea.
And from an artistic point of view, when it becomes problematic, I guarantee you that revenue model is going to, start to close up on you.
Right.
Right. Look at the revenue that was brought into Fox by season 10 of The X-Files that creatively had no avenues of exploration.
Right.
So when season 11 comes around, which suddenly is a liberated season of storytelling, except for some of the mythological conclusions that they're trapped into finding, it wasn't a revenue source for Fox because they'd hemorrhage so much of their audience from the dissatisfying storytelling of season 10.
I know, right?
So
such a trick. It's such a trick.
Perhaps our longest episode ever, 84
Perhaps
minutes.
Perhaps you cut in two, huh?
No, because we've literally gotten to half of the topics that we were going to get to today. So we'll be back. We're going to talk about movie marketing. We're going to talk about Tarantino and art house cinema and Hitchcock and Rope and a crazy change.org petition about a Hollywood landmark and Netflix that I can't wait to share with you. Be next week. And until then, thanks for putting up with us for this 85-minute show. I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Who was lost and lonely. Only a bitter tragic joke have found with you. The meaning of existence, oh my love.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas.
belated spoiler alert.